This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Tarek Mahana of Sudbury has been convicted of conspiring to help Al-Qaeda. And this week, he was sentenced to 17 and a half years in prison.
They knew he was not a danger by what he would do. He was only a threat because of what he would say.
Meanwhile, BU students were charged with hazing and assault and battery after apparent fraternity pledges were found in an Alston basement, mostly naked, bound, and beaten.
If we find it's a violation of our code of student responsibilities, then their status as a student at the university could be in jeopardy.
And fundraising in the Massachusetts Senate race. For every dollar Republican Senator Scott Brown raised in the last quarter, Democratic challenger Elizabeth Warren raised two.
Plus, more money news. The Massachusetts House released its budget, $14 million smaller and a lot different than Governor Deval Patrick's budget.
We don't want to undermine the state's economic recovery. We want to promote stability and consistency in our tax and cost structure.
Well, joining us now is E.J. Graff, resident scholar at Brandeis Women's Studies Research Center and a columnist and contributing editor at The American Prospect. E.J. Graff, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's great to be here.
Also, to help us sort through the week's news is Craig Sandler, general manager at the State House News Service. Craig, welcome back to you. Where are you?
Well, I'm kind of just working outside the big dig tunnel. Things aren't as maybe propitious on the Massachusetts transportation scene as they might be, at least not for one Craig R.
Okay.
Well, beautiful day here.
We'll draw a smiley face on a piece of paper and put it in the seat where you're supposed to be sitting in the studio now. But let's start off with the first story that we just outlined, and that is, of course, of Tarek Mahana and the fact that he was sentenced to 17 and a half years on charges of conspiring to assist Al-Qaeda. Here's a little bit of more tape from U.S. Attorney Alok Chakravarty. No relation to me, I should say, detailing his crimes.
For conspiring to support terrorists, for conspiring to kill Americans overseas, and for lying to the FBI.
I'm sorry, that is wrong. That is U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz, my fault. And then there was this.
Translating a variety of different materials to inspire, to recruit, and to provide support to Al-Qaeda.
Again, that's U.S. Attorney Carmen Ortiz, and saying that translating and posting documents to the web is really what first got First Amendment advocates up in arms, which is what Tarek Mahana was convicted for. Let me ask you, E.J. Graff, just your first thoughts on the fact that Tarek Mahana got 17 and a half years for a sentence.
Well, two and a half thoughts, I would say, since he had 17 and a half. Years. One is, I think it's really troubling. It's very troubling. It's a time that when it's very easy to convict anybody with a Muslim beard. And you know what I mean. I mean, there's no beard that's Muslim. But I wasn't in the courtroom. I wasn't on the jury, so I don't know exactly what the evidence was. But it sure does sound as if he was convicted for supporting the idea that Muslims in other countries should be able to fight back when invaded. That's a little distressing. And then the second thought I have is that it looks like civilian courts are better than military courts at convicting people accused of terrorism. The two of the three people who were convicted on material support charges and military commissions have already been set free, according to the Center for American Progress. And the criminal courts are giving much longer sentences.
Craig, I'm wondering what you think about what E.J. said. I mean, this case really has been talked about as representing a sort of an extension, an extending of federal prosecutorial reach, where we have someone here convicted of essentially for what he might have done as opposed to what he actually did.
That's right. Well, I mean, there's a lot of factors involved, and of course, one of the reasons this is such a difficult case is that it's right on the edge between issues of speech, civil liberties, and our desire to stay safe. So that, you know, one of the things that bothered me about the case is that he didn't seem necessarily to be convicted by a jury of his peers necessarily. But on the other hand, we have to say this is in fact America. We have a system of justice and trial by jury, and he was convicted after a hearing of the facts. And he was convicted in the context of, you know, an effort that we all got behind 11 years ago, an effort, an extraordinary effort, to stay safe. And that extraordinary effort didn't stop after we protected ourselves for 5 or 6 years. It's ongoing. Perhaps it is an extension, but on the other hand, perhaps it's not such a bad thing to be dancing along a line, erring on the side of caution when so far our record is perfect, preventing another act of terrorism.
Well, moving on to another story that caught everyone's attention this week, and that is, of course, alleged hazing going on at a Boston University fraternity. After responding to a noise complaint in Allston, Boston police found 5 BU students in a basement. They were in their underwear. They were bound together. It looks like they had been beaten, and the students were apparently pledging to Alpha Epsilon Pi fraternity. So EJ Graf, I just, you know, have to ask, this raises a question. The extreme question is, for how could this happen, and what does this mean for Greek life, at least on BU, on the BU campus?
Well, they was already off the BU campus. I mean, they had registered, or whatever the correct word is, with BU. BU had already gotten rid of them. So I know it's going to be played a little bit as a BU story, but I think it's a young men in groups story, an initiation rite story. I mean, every society has some kind of an initiation rite, and you can't get rid of them. But what you have to do is have them be publicly supervisable. So you have, you know, confirmation ceremonies, or you have, I don't know what, I can't think of good ones, but to leave young men in groups alone trying to outdo each other and how they can humiliate other young men puts you in that Zimbardo experiment, the Stanford prison experiment of 1971, where people in unequal positions of power behave horribly. And I think that's what happened here.
That's true, but that experiment, I think, probably involved, it did involve adults. And the fact is that the grown-ups in this case, and they understand that these people are sort of on the cusp of adulthood, but these people are under the supervision of adults, and it's time for the adults in the organization at BU, I think, to go farther than they have been, setting a tone of orderliness on that campus. It's interesting, of course, because of the legacy of Silber, who was known for being perhaps more authoritarian than other university administrations. So particularly for me as an alum of UMass, I mean, I'm not unfamiliar with problems with public perception, you know, after difficulties that the administration perhaps needs to take accountability for. I know that this week or the last couple of days, talking to alums at BU, you know, that they've really had it, and it is time for a cultural change. Part of this has to do with the hockey teams and the problems there. You can't go on saying things are coincidental forever, and a lot of it is image building. You have to take some dramatic gesture sometimes when you're running a big organization, just to signal enough is enough.
So let's move on to the state budget. On Wednesday, House Speaker Robert DeLeo released the House's $32 billion budget proposal. It differs in significant ways from Governor Deval Patrick's budget. For instance, there are no new taxes on candy and soda. There are significant differences in education spending. The House version also increases local aid. Here's House Budget Chairman Brian Dempsey.
We have reaffirmed our commitment to responsible budgeting by keeping the operating budget within our current means and do not shift the burden of balancing the budget onto the shoulders of Massachusetts taxpayers.
Craig, do you want to give us some of the sort of highlights of this budget and how it differs from the governor's budget?
Well, sure thing. Overall, the budget is actually one that advocates of all stripes can be encouraged about, and with the exception of the trial courts, notably, really are encouraged about it. I remember Megna played the gloom and doom music for Craig Chandler a few months ago. I'm happy to say your little ray of sunshine is back, Megna.
Oh, Craig.
It's a pretty, it is a budget that's producing relatively little reaction, which is always a good sign in terms of reception. The big differences are no taxes on, you know, candy and soda, which probably weren't going to fly in an election year anyway. They don't raise taxes if they can at all avoid it in an election year, and they can avoid it this year, which again is a good sign. The other big difference between this budget and the governor's budget is a complete lack, reform of the community college system. And that was pretty interesting to me because, I mean, I think Patrick made a cogent case about you know, training people for mid-skill jobs, and the strange, vague area the community college play now and the better place they might be able to play, that's out of the House budget. And I didn't see any, as they say, a sort of coherent, powerful, interesting alternative, whether that's protecting, you know, public jobs or people's friends, or whether it's just a lack of will. I'm not sure, but that is a big difference. People should not lose. People should not stop thinking about the community colleges in this state. They're important, and we've spent a lot of money on them. They probably could do better under a better system.
So, Craig, how are the politics going to play out over the coming weeks between the governor and the House leaders over these two versions?
I don't think that it's going to be a big problem for Patrick in this particular year. He's very focused on the presidential race, the party basically is, and the other items, spending on the big entitled on healthcare, on education generally, and on local aid. I think there's pretty broad agreement, and so I don't foresee a lot of contention, a showdown per se with the governor, particularly because a lot of the players, the people involved, they're kind of all going to be aligned to get Elizabeth Warren elected and Barack Obama reelected.
Well, on to the last story of the week. This week, Democratic Senate candidate Elizabeth Warren announced that she raised almost $7 million in the last reporting period. That's the first quarter of this year. That is more than double Republican Senator Scott Brown's $3.4 million that he raised. So, E.J. Graff, you spent some time watching this race, and you wrote a piece about it in The Nation. It's online now. And while money, of course, is one important element of politics, you found that this race really comes down to personality and character. Why?
It was really interesting for me to drive around the state following her and talking to people about what they thought of her and what they thought of Scott Brown, and also to think about the way the two of them are using stories, their life stories, as political parables about what kind of what kind of society we should have. They both come from some kind of disadvantage. His is obviously much worse. His is pretty extreme. The violent stepfathers and alcoholic mother and extreme hunger, and of course the sexual abuse. And he uses his story to get to the saying, look, hard work will be rewarded, do the right thing, and you too can be successful. I mean, I was successful. He doesn't put it in these words. And let's leave the losers behind, right? Reward the hard workers and leave the losers behind. She has a different story. She has a story of moderate disadvantage. Her father has the heart attack. They lose the family car because her mother has to go to work. They get by, but scraping. And she tells the story of her three brothers, who are sort of pillars of different forms of the middle class: a small businessman, a military man, and a brother who works in construction.
And the lesson you get from her story,
the lesson she draws from the story is, we managed to stay in the middle class because of a series of social props. And those props have all been taken away, and the game has been rigged in favor of the rich people and set up so that working middle class people are going to lose. And I don't know which one of them is going to win. I'm not as confident as you are that it's going to be Warren.
Well,
As Craig, he just said it's going to be Warren and Obama in the fall.
Because I'm not confident either way until the voters have their say.
I'm going to be working for them. I'm not confident that it's going to be Warren. I'm confident that all those Democrats are not going to be worried about the state budget as much as they're going to be worried about Warren. I have no confidence that she'll be elected.
I'll say about Warren is that the local Democratic activists in town after town are just crazy about her. They're turning cartwheels. They basically want to touch the hem of her garment.
Does Scott Brown bring that kind of excitement on the other side?
I wasn't seeing that right yet. Hmm. But what I do see is that he's an incredibly savvy campaigner, he is running as an independent who builds bridges. I mean, I'm quoting his words, and painting her as a bomb thrower and a pinhead. He doesn't use the word pinhead. All you have to do is say academic.
Let me ask you a question. So now we basically know that Mitt Romney is going to be on the ballot for the Republican side regarding the presidential race. So, there's a received wisdom that says having President Obama on the Democratic side might help Elizabeth Warren. Is Mitt Romney being on the ballot going to help Senator Scott Brown?
Well, you know, I think it's not. I think it's probably going to hurt him a little bit for exactly for that reason.
I agree.
People are not actually, interestingly, in Massachusetts, people are not necessarily going to be really motivated to vote against Mitt Romney. There might be a slightly muted anti-Romney dynamic there. But on the other hand, EJ's right, and by the way, the piece is unbelievable. Everybody can learn from it. I certainly did. So everybody read the piece. But the other thing is, I think that Scott Brown is hoping to make the case, and a very good one he can make. You don't want all Democrats. Yes, you're going to go vote for Barack, but at the same time, as you like to do, I'm the Republican who can counterbalance. So, you know, put that into play, and I'm an independent mind. You've seen me stand up to the right, to the far right of my party, so you know you can. You know I'm not going to be buying anybody's dogma as Warren might. He's got to cross his fingers and hope that people here are going to assume that Obama's going to be reelected, and strangely, and that the independents turn out and are somewhat muddled in how they feel on the presidential race and do want that perceived independent and even counterculture in this state voice on the Republican side. I think that's kind of a tough road. The dynamics are tough for Scott Brown. I also think he's such a good campaigner, and he does have such an interesting message. It could still happen.
And he's so personable. He really is. And he's a guy. And how many female senators have we sent to Washington?
From Massachusetts.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, let's turn to our weekly hubbub before we run out of too much time. And that, of course, is the story that didn't quite make it above the fold, as we say. And EJ, let's start with you. What's your hubbub?
Oh, well, it was the hashtag, the fake Massachusetts town hashtag.
Twitter.
Oh, my God, it hijacked my day. I'm going to read some of them that came through. Scroton, Unstable. Ham, Thingham, Indighton, Snobscott, Soxborough. Oh, you're going to have to stop me because I love them all.
Yeah,
I submitted Casino Ham, Casino Shire, and Witch.
I liked Witch. North Affleck, I liked that one.
Yeah, exactly. I submitted Au Gratin and was content with
it. I submitted Wicked Shire.
Oh, I loved that one. I definitely, yeah, that that's on my list.
I think that hashtag is still going on Twitter. It's fake math towns, right?
Niptucket.
Craig, 20 minutes on it on Radio Boston next week. What do you think?
Craig, what's your hubbub?
Well, I also run the News Service of Florida down in Tallahassee, Florida. It's the clone of the Massachusetts, the State House News Service in Boston. But, of course, it's not really the clone because Florida is in a different nation, as we know, or anyone who's spent any time there knows. And Martha Coakley got into that a little bit, talking about the special prosecutor in the Trayvon Martin case this week when she was asked about the special prosecutor's request that everyone pray in Florida for the prosecution team. She was asked, Jim Browdy took umbrage, and Coakley was asked about it. She said that she wasn't going to ask anybody to pray. Absolutely unthinkable in this state, absolutely normal behavior, and I loved down in Florida, and I loved the way Coakley put it. That's just the Florida of Florida. It is amazing the degree to which, as you travel around this country, you perceive how there's more than one nation.
Many.
Because there just really is more than one culture. And having high public officials urge people to pray their way through to successful outcomes, that's, you know, it's standard operating procedure in Florida. It really is. We cover it all the time at the News Service of Florida. It was just a delightful moment for me.
Wow. Well, my hubbub is another small delight, and that has to do, actually, it's also has a bit of a religious theme as well, and that is an old print of Paul Revere's that was discovered in a book at Brown University in the library there. It was tucked inside the back cover of a 19th century book called The Modern Practice of Physics, and apparently this was an old print that Revere had made that depicts Jesus and John the Baptist in the Jordan River. Only one of five that's known, and they didn't know it was in this book until someone happened to be flipping through it. So that's my shout out to actual physical books and libraries.
You're not going to get that on your e-reader.
Exactly.
That's fantastic.
A delightful find. Anthony?
All right.
So my hubbub, I'm not sure what the local connection is unless you can count the millions of listeners we have who are also fans of the great rock and roll group The Who. So that's the way I'm going to draw this connection. So it turns out the organizers of the London Olympics are trying to organize a symphony of rock, which is a celebration of British pop culture that will be part of the game's closing ceremony. So they invited the great drummer of The Who, Keith Moon. The problem is Keith Moon died. In 1978, he was a brilliant drummer. He died at the age of 32, so a little egg on the face of the organizers of the London Olympics. But let's hear it for Keith Moon.
How do they not know? They're a British band. Oh, my goodness. Well, Craig Sandler, general manager at the Statehouse News Service, great to have you as always. Drive safely and see you in the studio next time.
Absolutely. I got to go over to Widener at Harvard now, start pouring through the basement. Maybe I'll find something.
If they let you in. E.J. Graff, resident scholar at the Brandeis University's Women's Studies Research Center and columnist and contributing editor at the American Prospect. Great to have you as well.
Oh, wonderful to be here.
Stay with us. Coming up, the biggest story of the week. It's opening day at Fenway Park. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Radio Boston. Pick up my guitar and play. Just like